Hello, it's Fabio Akira again from the Ruby on Rails Brazil podcast, and now I have John Straw. He is from yellowpage.com, and he has one of the most interesting Ruby on Rails projects around. So welcome, John, and please introduce yourself, what you do at Yellow Pages, and
what else?
Okay, I run our internal software architecture group at yellowpages.com. I guess for the purposes of this discussion, what makes me interesting is not that, but that I ran the development team on the project in which we re-implemented our yellowpages.com website in Ruby on Rails.
Okay, so before the big rewrite project, you had a Java website that's yellowpages.com. It was built around J2EE. What were the pieces that were together back then?
Well, like you said, yeah. It was a pretty big pile of code, I guess. It had been built. Actually, the architecture dated from back before yellowpages.com existed in its current form. So we put yellowpages.com together out of several companies, and we ended up with this site architecture that involved actually several different layers. There was a hardware web acceleration layer, and there was a web server layer, and then there's a Java application server layer. And while the application was nominally J2EE, it was actually extremely dependent on or designed around the proprietary features of the application server. So we got to a point in our ongoing development where we felt that the application server platform was falling behind technologically. It had certain really critical misfeatures from our point of view. For example, as we tried to do SEO work on the platform, it was very hard to make URLs that didn't have baked-in session management features that URLs that Googlebot would like. And it was actually, for example, impossible to generate a 301 redirect from inside the application server. So we were really constrained by what we could do. So we conceived of this plan to move off of that application server and onto a new application server.
Okay. A lot of companies that use Java nowadays, they use Java primarily because of they've been using Java already. They think it's easier to find Java programmers in the market, and they just feel safe that Java has been around for like 10 years. So back then, didn't you feel like people were more interested? If they have to rewrite the whole thing, they would rewrite it in Java so they can reuse what they know?
Well, that was definitely our initial plan, actually. And we conceived of it as a project to re-implement the site on a different application server, probably JBoss, since it was kind of the leading application server at the time, and certainly among free, and actually our CTO had prior experience with it in another job, and it worked with people who contributed to the project. And while we liked that, the more we looked at it, we felt like given the amount of work we had to do, the length of time we had in which to do it, we needed help from a framework. We couldn't start from first principles and write a bunch of servlets, so we needed some sort of web framework. And when we looked at our problem domain, none of the Java web frameworks we were willing to consider gave us enough help to accomplish our aims, our requirements in that as we looked at this problem. So,
okay, so you did test some Java frameworks that were around, or just the JBoss, Seam stuff?
We looked at Seam. We actually built a test application in Seam. I looked at Spring some. I did a brief survey of available frameworks. You know, I can't say that I tried every single thing, but I had some Struts experience. I knew a little bit about Spring, and it was easy to eliminate a bunch of them because the thing we were most concerned about from an interface perspective, which was having controllable URLs for things in our system in an attempt to maximize our SEO crawlability, was something that none of the Java frameworks I knew about seemed to care about at all. We talked about it with engineers who were working on Seam, and they said, oh, you know, that's an interesting thing we haven't thought about. You know, maybe you could help us build that. And then so at that point, it was not it just didn't seem like a thing that people were interested in. What those frameworks did seem to be oriented toward was making it really easy to build transactional websites. You know, the Seam demo is a reservation site, or like a hotel reservation site, and really sort of multi-request transactional mechanisms, and none of that interested us for our problem, which is build a local search website with, you know, with a solid stateless API that is easily crawlable. So,
okay, and then how did you came across Ruby on Rails?
Well, I guess it was this started in the summer of 2006, and it was sort of common knowledge. People were talking about it. Actually, later when we were actually choosing the platform, it was close to a year later in early 2007, and I was telling people at the time, you know, if we had made this decision a year ago, it would have been controversial, but now it's kind of a boring decision. Everybody is aware of it, and it's not all that out there. But I know that in the summer of 2006, I was thinking about Rails, and in fact, when I was talking to the JBoss engineers, we said, you know, well, why shouldn't we just build this site in Rails? And they said, well, it won't scale the traffic that you need. And we said, okay, you know, so we'll keep thinking about doing this in Java. And then, you know, later we changed our minds, obviously.
But did you already had Ruby programmers inside, or did you have to train everybody else? Just you were the mentor. How many Java programmers were around there back then?
Our total development team, all the people who worked on consumer-facing applications, was between 12 and 20 people. Closer to 10 worked on the website on a regular basis. We had one programmer who had played with Rails in school. He had just graduated, and so he knew a little bit, and that was pretty much it. We hired one consultant, actually a guy our CTO had worked with in the past, and he had done much more Rails work than anybody else. Everyone else was learning as we went.
Okay, and because many companies have this problem that they have lots of Java programmers, so they really want to know how hard it is to make those Java programmers actually productive in a new environment like Ruby on Rails that's so radically different than the Java environment that they are used to. So what were the problems or the surprises that you had during this transition?
Well, first, most of the work that we did on the big rewrite was done with a team not so much of Java programmers, but of talented programmers, you know, people who were comfortable working in different languages. I have something of a Java background, but I've written a fair amount of ELISP and Perl and other sorts of languages. Another key member of the team was really more of a Python developer than a Java developer, although he liked both. We had one guy who was really suspicious of any language that didn't have C-like syntax, you know, and that was actually a big stumbling block for him, was dealing with the fact that there were no curly braces. As one of the things we wanted to be able to do over the course of the project was introduce the larger development team, or the larger development community in our organization to the platform choices that we had made and made them comprehensible. So I spent quite a bit. I mean, first I let the other developers on the team take the lead in explaining our technological choices and why we were headed to where we were, and give people pointers on the new environment, what it would be like, where they should go for information. And that turned into a fairly long flame war, maybe, thread on an internal email of people all trying to understand why we had done what we did and where we were going and what the future would look like. And then that became, you know, a 3 or 4 hour town hall meeting, you know, if you could describe a meeting with 15 people in it as a town hall, where I tried to explain the goals of our architectural redesign, what I was trying to accomplish, and why I thought picking a dynamic language was appropriate. You know, and some people were receptive to the idea, especially actually when the developer I mentioned before, who didn't like anything that wasn't C, stood up and said, I really didn't believe this, but now I've been using it and it's really nice and it's one of the best things I've used. But, you know, some people were receptive, some people were skeptical, but you know, but willing to think about it. And some people were really hostile to the idea, you know. And ultimately, there's a big job market out there, and you should work on something that you like. And if you can't stand the technology you're forced to work on, then you should look for someplace else to go.
Yeah, that's right. And it's obviously difficult to describe the architecture without diagrams, but can you make a brief overview of what you had before and what was the new changes that were the challenge, the transition and the new changes in architecture?
Well, before it was pretty much a self-contained website application. It had, we're a local search site, so part of our application is implemented in a separately scaled search layer. Really, the way it worked in before the transition, we had some code that was in the search layer, and then we had a lot of other code that was inside the actual Java application. And one of the real problems with that, other than just the platform problems I described before, was that when it came time for us to write another application that also needed access to search, we wrote an API application that was serving a small but growing amount of our traffic. That application needed to re-implement the portions of the search logic which were in the website application. That code wasn't reusable because of the way that it had been written, and so we ended up with two independent and divergent search implementations. And I considered that to be an unsupportable scheme going forward. We needed to be able to get more leverage and more code reuse out of that search code, especially because the search part is really finicky. There are a small number of people who understand how it works, so we needed to be able to reuse that as widely as possible. And then also, and this gets more important as we go forward and we think of mobile device support and other sorts of things, and we added, say, personalization. We added to the site the ability for users to save favorite pages and bookmark and stuff like that, and add write reviews, and those needed to be available on other distribution platforms as well. Our API powered our mobile site, and it didn't have any access to the personalization details or the ratings and reviews which were written on the main site unless the API team re-implemented that code as well. So looking at those basic problems, I figured we needed a service-oriented architecture. We needed a set of common business services or common site services which would provide search services, personalization services, and other services to a variety of applications. Over time, I still think that's the right decision. I mean, it makes sense for us. Some of the details about it, you know, are in flux, perhaps, and we're still in the process of making all of our apps talk to these common services. But that was the core idea, was that we had to refactor the locked up code inside the website that needed to be commonly used out into a place where it could be used across different applications. So that was the primary idea, that we would establish a common service tier that would be used by different applications. We figured that tier had to be fast and had to be scalable, since everything would depend on it. So our initial idea was that was going to be, you know, a high-powered EJB3, J2EE application running in JBoss. And then once we had done that, once we had put the important, you know, once we put all the hard work in this enterprise-y Java code, then we had the freedom to consider using a relatively slow dynamic language platform that was good at building websites for the website portion. So we figured that we would probably be deploying alongside of that the actual website code. Actual website would be in a framework like Rails in Ruby or Django in Python, which were sort of the two that I had been watching most. And we had people who liked, we were less familiar actually with Ruby when we started than with Python, but we liked both languages. And Ruby looked enough like Perl that it made sense to me. So even though it's actually, in practice, it's actually not all that much like Perl, but, you know, at least superficially it seemed Perl-like. So that was a rough sketch of, I guess, where we were going, you know, where we were and where we were going on the architectural front, I guess.
This part is interesting because I saw in your presentation that you were kind of going for a AGB container, and then you decided you didn't need that, and you replaced it with Rails application at the back end as well. So did you find it was less productive to do in either EJB, or the performance was not that important, or
what? Well, so what happened really was that we started prototyping things. You know, we needed to learn what the search code did, but in a way which left us free to do it better. We didn't want to understand it so completely that we were intellectually trapped into re-implementing it in the same way. So we did sort of a mix of reading the code and reverse engineering the code from its outputs, from the queries that it sent to our search layer. And because the people on the team who were doing that were most comfortable in Python, we ended up with a simple little Python app, which became the core of our prototype service tier. And in time, that became an app built on Twisted, which is this really nifty Python library for doing event-driven asynchronous programming and Python network programming. And so we had this Python Twisted service tier, which knew how to do sort of enough services to build prototypes. It knew how to do enough types of searches that we could work on the rest of the site. And we realized over time, you know, that we were stalling on, we figured we would go back and we would do this again as a Java app, and we kept putting it off. And we did some EJB3 training, try and learn more about JBoss, and the wider development team went to that. And the core next gen site team who went to that, they came out of that training wanting nothing to do with EJB3. It was a lot better than previous versions of EJB, but we looked at it and it looked like a lot of pain and difficulty for not much benefit for our particular application, which again is, you know, mostly read only, not transactional at all. You know, so what we needed was something that would take some query terms and figure out the right set of searches to run against that. And it's not it didn't map. EJB3 didn't provide us with any advantages, and the container maybe was an advantage. And when you looked at the services offered by the application server platform, their sort of deployment services and caching and other sorts of things, but they just didn't seem compelling. Mm-hmm. So in the end, we were riding on these Python services, and we were kind of thinking maybe we'd stick with those, or maybe we'd try and do it again. So we ended up rewriting the Python stuff in Ruby, and this was actually primarily just as a straight Ruby library, because we were maybe thinking we would include it directly in the web tier, maybe not, although I was pretty set on the idea of having a separate services application. So in the end, we were able to, our Ruby library progressed to the point where we felt like it would work, and we felt there was some benefit from, you know, not having yet another implementation language. So we wrote two tiers in Ruby on Rails.
Awesome.
Sort of.
And another thing that's interesting, you mentioned that one thing that you like the most about Ruby on Rails is that it comes with its own testing framework that you could already use out of the box. So it feels like you were very interested in having tests from the beginning. Was that something that you were already doing the Java front with maybe JUnit or something, or it was a new trend as well, doing test-driven development or something like that?
We had essentially no tests at all in the old site. So that was, and that had definitely been something I'd been interested in for a long time. I'd been reading lots of stuff about test-driven development. And I had actually done some work in Perl over sort of the previous year before we did this, where I started writing test harness tests in Perl and really liked it. But I'd always suffered whenever I read about JUnit and thought, if I were smarter, I'd be doing this. You know, this is the right way to go. I could never figure out how to use it in my context. It was always obvious how you would test a library with JUnit to me, you know, because you have a defined interface and you know what the outputs are supposed to be, and you can write that. But I was never working on libraries. I was always working on websites. And I didn't understand. I wasn't clever enough to come up with a solid way of testing the stuff I needed in JUnit. So I never did it, and no one else, it didn't seem like anybody else I was in contact with had solved that problem either. And it was really, it was a bit of a revelation to see in the Rails community how seriously they took test-driven development, to the extent that the framework came with, you know, came with conventions which made it trivial to write automated tests. And even further, the community, and it was the first community I'd ever really interacted or experienced which had this feeling, you know, they did that. They actually did it, and they expected it, you know, and they were so interested in it that they were writing all sorts of new testing stuff, and people were arguing about the best way to write tests. In Java development I had been exposed to, people just didn't write tests, much less argue about the best way to do it. So, yeah, that was a really important part of the overall decision.
And now the whole team is used to do TDD.
Well, you know, it's hard to do TDD, you know. It's mm-hmm. it's more of an intention uh-huh. than a reality sometimes, but it's, you know, it's still something that we want to do. We do write tests. We have test coverage now. It's not 100% across the board. You know, it's different for different members, but it's something that we recognize and we socialize as a thing that that the best developers do. They write tests. And occasionally we use peer pressure to humiliate the people.
Peer pressure
to say, actually, one of the developers who came on later after we had done this wrote a plugin which counts up the amount of tests committed by different developers. He calls it Kablame, actually, and it goes through and it sees who's committing test code. And recently we're trying out a process of doing peer review. We've decided we're experimenting with having each developer have a buddy and have the buddy do a review of code after it's committed and before we allow it into our trunk. And one of the things that peer is going to be, is going to be instructed to check for is testing, especially on issue fixes. You know, if you're fixing a defect, then you should really be committing a test.
Exactly. And does your team uses any agile practices, maybe some XP stuff or Scrum stuff?
Well, our CTO is a big proponent of agile development. So he came in about 8 or 9 months before this project and immediately said, I want us to be agile. And so one of our less prominent goals in our site rewrite project was to try and figure out how to do that, how to be agile in our environment. It's again something we aspire to. The thing we did really well during the rewrite was iteration-based development. You know, we did in part because we were running a public beta, which was also really unusual for us, is a thing that seems obvious to everybody, but was something we had never done before and took a lot of arguing before we got to the point where we were willing to do it. But we had the beta site up, and I pushed code to it all the time. You know, as we finished something or as we felt like it was there, we would deploy it and it would be available. And that was, in our particular project, it was extremely important to do that. So we had been doing kind of short release cycles for a while, and during our site rewrite project, during our big rewrite, it got more prevalent. At this point, we're still sort of there. And we have teams who practice Scrum. I'm sort of more a fan of small A agile in general than of any particular flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So teams getting together, lots of communication, QA people integrated with development teams, testing, test-driven development, I think, or at least following your development with tests, I think is extremely important. I think probably you always feel like you could be doing better at that, but we're better this year than we were last year and much better than we were 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I understand that you work for AT&T, is that correct? Yellow Pages from
yellowpages.com, which is the site yellowpages.com is run by a wholly owned subsidiary of AT&T. So at the time we did this project, we were called yellowpages.com LLC, but now we're actually called AT&T Interactive because our scope has broadened a little bit. But we're sort of a separate organization that has a parent company, AT&T.
Oh. So being inside this kind of company, traditional, quote-unquote, does it make it difficult to do new things like trying Rails or trying Agile? Do you feel that you have this kind of a defensive attitude for coming from the high?
Well, it probably would if we were more mainstream, but because of the way, because of basically historical quirks about how our company came to in existence, we were off to the side and out of the technical mainstream at AT&T. So, you know, we had we didn't have to follow their rules about how to do things or maybe how not to do things. So that made it a lot easier. You know, and since then I've had some contacts with different people inside AT&T, and their questions kind of boil down to how on earth did you manage to do this? Running a software architecture group, this is one of the personal challenges for me, because in that kind of environment, when you have such a large organization, software architecture generally plays a role of enforcing standards, you know, mm-hmm. setting standards, enforcing them, making sure people don't go off and do anything innovative, because it's difficult to manage a large technical organization if people are creative. And I didn't like being a worker in that kind of environment where I had to get permission to use a particular technology and, you know, had to embarrass myself in front of vendors by saying things like I can't use free software in any of my applications. So trying to figure out what my role can be, how I can provide guidance without writing lots of documents and forcing people to sign variances is kind of personally tricky.
It still is a challenge.
Yes.
Okay. And I know that this particular transition, now it's successful, you were able to finish it, and now you're evolving the platform. And I know you have pretty impressive numbers that I want you to share, like, for instance, the famous before you had like 100-something thousand codes of Java.
It was, you know, the counting lines of code is obviously inherently stupid.
Yes.
But it's useful for scale, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We had, by my count, using slot count, we had about 125,000 lines of Java code in our website. And this was just the website. And there were fewer than 100 lines of test code.
100 lines?
Yeah, maybe. You know, I mean, there was one tiny directory that had a few JUnit tests, okay, and nobody ran them, and we weren't quite even sure what they tested. And when we started this project, we had just actually finished this. We had just finished a project where we added ratings and reviews to the site, the ability to rate a business. And by my count, it took us almost 30,000 lines of code to add that feature, which I considered a fairly trivial feature to the site. And there were different reasons for that, and it's completely unfair to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote some of that code, so it's not like I'm pointing fingers at somebody else, but it was hard to get that integrated. And so when we started the site, we wanted to put a new skin on the site, and we wanted to try and achieve our get off of our application server plans. And we had been given a really short timeline, about 4 months to do it. And I said, there's no way that if we have to write 100,000 lines of code to do this, there's no way we'll get finished in 3 months. So we have to be able to write less code. And so we need the power that a dynamic language, that being able to do bottom-up programming, gives us,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a framework which makes it easy, which is oriented toward building websites, you know, not toward, Bill DeHora said this one time, I thought it was a great line, so I repeat it all the time. He's talking, I think, about ETAG, but the sense you get from most Java frameworks is that they're not interested in websites, they're about the important business of talking to middleware. You know, mm-hmm. the web is a pattern that you work around so that you can talk to middleware. We didn't have any middleware we wanted to talk to. We just wanted to build a website. So this is a long answer for just what we wanted was two numbers. But in the end of the project, we wrote fewer than 20,000 lines of Ruby code. And something between a third to a half of that was actually test code.
Which feels very nice now.
Yeah, it was.
And
it
you
was
run
great.
Them.
In our service tier, in this common services tier, we had more test code than actual program code after the rewrite, and our coverage was, you know, was at least within visible distance of 100% on the important search library code.
Mm-hmm. And in this rewrite, you changed the architecture, but from the user point of view, the same features that were there before are still in the new website, or did you reduce the scope as well?
I tried really hard over the course of the project to reduce the features supported by the website, but I basically failed across the board. I managed to eliminate one feature over time. I thought that was another thing that was going to have to happen in order for us to make our deadlines, is that we'd have to reduce the scope of the site and we'd have to focus more and then come back and fill in. No one else agreed with me. And in the end, you know, we actually, the site was pretty feature complete, or was at least comparable in terms of the overall features it supported afterward.
And now
compared to before.
You are building new features now.
Yes, we've built some new things since then.
And in terms of just to give an idea of the size of YellowPages, how many servers are we talking about? What's the numbers in terms of infrastructure?
The site itself, well, at launch, we launched on 50 machines and 2 data centers, which were split between the web application and the common services application and the database layer. So we had, I think, 17 machines in the web tier, 6 machines in the service tier, and then 2 database servers in each of our 2 data centers. And then we didn't change anything from the search cluster, so that was scaled the same way it had been before. There are, you know, a little bit more than 100 machines in that
100?
Layer. Yeah.
Whoa, that's big.
Yeah, well, right now we run about 3,600 queries per second against that layer across both our data centers, so it's a high query volume. And, you know, it's not the 10,000 machines Yahoo has, but then we're a lot smaller than them. The site itself, I don't have great numbers about this, but by ComScore's visitor counts, we're sort of around the 30th largest website in the U.S. We get on the order of 25 to 30 million unique visitors a month. I think I saw something like 165 million requests a day. I'm not sure about that number.
How many requests a day?
I don't think that's right. Maybe that's a month. I have some numbers. I have numbers that I looked up in May in the presentation that I gave here.
So there are pretty big numbers.
Yeah, they're you know, it was actually, to be honest, it was a consideration for us actually when we were thinking about the platform shift, and this was more my boss thinking it than me, because I was nervous about the thing more than excited. He looked at it and we said, you know, there's a chance that if we do this, if we switch to Rails, we'll be the biggest or maybe the second biggest Rails site in the world. And that would be exciting, you know, it'd be a way to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of just being another Java site, we'd be this special thing.
Yeah.
So while we were doing it, you know, Twitter sort of came into existence, and now nobody's quite sure. But as I say periodically, I'm not so interested in being number one, but being in the top five is certainly
pretty bold.
And we'd like to be bigger than we are.
So you're still growing in infrastructure, in users per month. The site is still in.
After we launched, over the next year or so, site traffic doubled.
Doubled.
After,
whoa.
After our site launch to where we are today.
And you're not. Are you near the full capacity of your infrastructure, or still?
As that traffic doubled, we added fewer than 5 machines to each data center, I think. So we actually overestimated. And we had to order the hardware far in advance of the time we had code we were able to profile. So, and we made a guess at this 25 machines thing and then ended up splitting them as they were. We found our web tier runs a lot hotter, has always been closer to capacity than the service tier. Service tier had a lot of headroom on it. So we've added 1 or 2 machines in 1 data center to the service tier. We've added 3 or 4 to the web tier from time to time, but we're still doing pretty well.
Would you say that the new application is generally comparable to the old one in terms of performance, or do you feel that you lost a little bit?
When we launched, it was definitely comparable, and then we noticed that because we started doing things we'd never done before, since we had gone through and we had pared down the number of queries that we were issuing against the search cluster, and we had extensively utilized caching in a global way that we'd never done before. The old app had lots of caching in it, but it was all user session based caching, so it was actually worse than useless in some ways, because it meant that the application spent a lot of time trying to rebuild those caches for no particular gain. So we replaced that with global caching and Memcached, and an architecture which was designed around that availability and short-term caching of frequently looked up objects. So it not only simplified our code, but we found that it reduced the load on our search infrastructure to about 20% of what it had been before. And after a few more performance optimizations, after we basically then, as we looked at our performance, it was okay, but not great at launch. But in almost all the reasons why it was bad, it wasn't because it was taking us a long time to generate the HTML, but rather because our site design was really image heavy. It required about 47 separate connections to load our homepage from cold cache. So then we started attacking those things. We started going through Yahoo's 13 website performance guidelines, which I can't recommend enough. They know what they're talking about. And attacking those things gave us a tremendous benefit. So by the time we were done, by the time we pushed images to a CDN, to an Akamai CDN, and we combined and minified the JavaScript and CSS files that we had on our site. And we haven't done everything. We experimented with sprites. We found that they maybe hurt a little bit more than they helped for our particular case. I think all the technical people would still like to simplify our design a little bit more so it doesn't have quite so many rounded corners and doesn't look quite so Web 2.0-ish. Anyway, when we were done with that, our site was faster than it had been when it was on Java.
Awesome. Yeah, because most people, especially newbies in programming, they look at micro benchmarks and they say, oh, take a look, Java is like 100 times faster than Ruby, but the complex web servers have much more than that. They have network bottlenecks, databases, caching, and a lot of other stuff to care about. And I think the main reason of everybody switching to Ruby is the productivity, I think. What you gain in terms of a quality of code and time life cycle development. Do you feel that you had this jump in productivity as well?
Well, I mean, certainly in the sense that we were able to re-implement a site that had taken 22 months to build the first time in 4 months with a team of primarily four people. It was an argument I made explicitly to our leadership as we were talking about doing this, that it's more important to develop quickly than to run quickly. That as long as our site was designed around solid architectural principles, which allowed us to scale horizontally with traffic, and the time that it took to serve an individual request was fast enough, then it was more important that we be able to develop the code and to do a good job and have maintainable code and maximize developer time than it was to try and get the absolute fastest execution time. And it's certainly true that when you're talking about a website, the principles of having a performant website are not server-side architecture specific. They are the same principles for Yahoo, whose site is primarily PHP, as they are for us. They're be stateless as much as possible, scale horizontally, practice shared nothing, or push your session container as low as you can. Take care with your actual page design to understand where the real bottlenecks are, and they're generally on the client side. They're the user's network pipe, especially their upload bandwidth. And so if you look carefully at how many connections they have to open in order to get access to your site, that can be a much more important factor even than the size of their download pipe.
Yeah.
And how quickly you can serve, how quickly you can serve HTML, we had a lot of work to get to before that was the long bar in our performance.
Okay, and now that you have enough experience with Ruby on Rails, what would you say are the main, top five things that you like about Rails and maybe some things that you don't like that you would like to have different or improved or something?
Well, I used to say pretty consistently, because I thought it was a good line, that routing is the best thing about Rails, and it's also the worst thing about Rails. What I like about Rails, and I think this also applied to Django, is that they start out thinking about the paths, thinking about your routes to the resources that you're going to provide. And that was definitely our biggest concern going into it, right? We wanted to be able to specify exactly what our URLs looked like. And in this case, we were also willing to fight a little bit with Rails about how those routes looked. Rails is kind of famously opinionated about things, and I think that's a good thing. we had to fight some of those opinions a little bit with how we wanted stuff to be laid out, because we thought that we would get more SEO benefit from doing it a slightly different way. So definitely, I love the fact that these new frameworks let you control the way your paths look, the way your URLs are structured. That's a great thing. I've said before, I think the emphasis on test automation and providing the facilities necessary to test your code is wonderful. My understanding from people who have trouble scaling Rails is that Active Record is one of the weak spots. For us, this was a calculated risk because we knew how much of our site depended on fast database performance, and it was a small portion. So there have been times when Active Record's model, which is, again, mostly okay for the sorts of sites that it's designed for, doesn't work quite well for us. There's one case in particular, say, where I needed to be able to build a large query of things. I wanted to affirmatively cache a large set of objects, like 500,000 things, and it was a derived set, so it didn't follow the convention of having a numeric ID, and that turned out basically to not be possible in Active Record. I had to drop all the way down to Ruby OCI for that to do it effectively. But that freedom is there, right? You can use the Active Record finders. You can drop to SQL when you need to. And if you're really desperate, you can go all the way. You can go even closer to the metal. And that was actually an important part for us. This is maybe the one thing I learned in CS in college. That story about IBM and the assembler operating system. The operating system they wrote in assembly, right? You optimize only the hotspots.
Yeah.
So when we looked at our platform, we saw that we would have the alternative of dropping down to C in places where we needed more performance. I don't know. At this point, this is starting to sound like you're talking to DHH instead of me, except my accent is less interesting than his. But I think he's right about that stuff. Most of the time you don't need it, and it's there when you do.
Yeah, that's what Dijkstra would say, that you shouldn't optimize first, and you should make it work first, and then optimize.
Right. And programmers prematurely optimize all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I used to write that down. There's like a funny saying: don't optimize, mm-hmm. and then for advanced users only, don't optimize yet.
Okay. Well, I think this is it. Do you have any remarks about the project per se, or any other things that you would say to new Ruby on Rails programmers coming up on board?
Well, I would say you need to think carefully about your problem. You need to understand the performance ramifications of your problem. My application is maybe not like your application, but then few applications are exactly the same. So just because I've been successful doesn't mean that you can't, that you shouldn't do your own homework, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand what you're doing. And one of the thing I told this time around that I haven't told before was the actual process, the amount of work that we did ahead of time. We say we did our development in 4 months, and it's true. We did another 4 months of prototyping. We spent the time to understand enough about the platforms to make a decision to figure out how we would approach the problem, and that time was invaluable. Because we did that, we had confidence that we had made an acceptable decision. And the other thing, and one of the things I like about Agile, is it's not the last. It's not the last system. You always get, if you're lucky, you get a chance to go back and fix your mistakes later. And we built the best system that we could in the time that we had. And then as new developers came on, they looked at parts of it and held their noses and complained about them. And then they started refactoring them. And by that process, things get better. And it's a healthy process.
Exactly. Okay, thank you very much. That was a very insightful interview.
Well, thanks. I appreciated having a chance to talk.